in the name of Jesus, and we say that rather glibly, but I think what we mean when we say that, if we understand what we mean, is we greet you in Jesus' stead. Not that we can take his place, but he's not here, and I have the responsibility this morning to say what he would say if he were here. That is a very awesome responsibility. So you pray as we go through this message this morning. Now, this is Mother's Day, but I'm going to turn you to Genesis chapter 24, and we have a beautiful domestic scene here. And I'm not going to say much about mothers, but we do have a potential mother in this chapter, and I think she turned out to be a very good mother. In fact, I think she's often been somewhat dubiously criticized, and as I studied through these passages, I came to a new appreciation of Rebecca, and that'll come out as we go along. Now, and I also want to welcome the visitors. It's a privilege to have you with us. We love to enlarge our circle of fellowship. We love to make new friends here in this congregation. And I hope when you leave here, you will feel warmly received and welcome. The title of the message, I tried to, this is a real challenge. If you do three chapters and then you try to find a connecting theme that pulls them all together. And the thing that struck me as I was going through these three chapters, it was the term passing the torch. Abraham dies in the middle of this whole thing, and we have the torch passed to Isaac, and we even sort of have the beginnings of the torch that finally gets passed to Jacob. So in this passage, we're basically talking about the passing of the torch of faith, the torch of the covenant, the torch of the kingdom, the torch of all God's purpose for that little group of people that he called his peculiar people, the people he's watching with particular interest and particular resources and particular favors. That's the torch we're talking about this morning. And so we're talking about passing the torch. Now, when I thought about that, of course, immediately I thought of the Olympic Games, which are going to take place, I understand, beginning August the 8th. And even as we speak, the torch is being passed. It's been being passed since the beginning of March. I got some information from Brother Wendell. He usually is a repository of all these details, and I'm not. So I called him, and so I want to give credit for that. But anyway, they started passing this torch. It's going to be passed for about 9 months. Of course, the Olympic Games honor the original Olympic Games back during the ancient time of Greece. And so they passed that torch beginning in the Valley of Olympus, where those games originally held. They light the torch there, and it's passed through all the countries on its way to the host country. It went through Russia, it went through various European countries, went through England, came to the United States, went to California, went down into South America, and now is somewhere, I think, in China being passed around. And it will eventually end up in Beijing, where the games are going to be held. And that will be quite an event, because the final episode is the lighting of the Olympic torch, which will burn throughout the game, and I'll just mention in a minute what that's going to represent. But anyway, when the torch finally arrives in that stadium, the runner will run around the stadium several times, and then the host country's chief of state will stand up and declare the games to be open. The Olympic flag will be raised, the trumpets will play, the cannons will boom in salute, hundreds of doves will be released into the air as a sign of peace, which is what those games are supposed to signify, peace among all nations. In a way, it sort of symbolizes the aspiration and dream of man. There's something in man that knows that people should be able to live together in peace, and that people carry that ideal. They never completely surrender that. And to me, the Olympic Games is a testimony of the fact that here's an ideal that the devil can never completely quench. You know, the Bible says that he's not able to completely quench the light. It says the darkness cannot comprehend the light or quench it out. And I think the Olympic Games is one example of that. It shows us there's a light there. There's an ideal. There's a God-given purpose that he's placed in the heart of every person, and our whole world is going to celebrate that in Beijing, of all places. Well, anyway, they're going to light that torch, and it's going to burn throughout these games, and these games and the torch and everything represents this desire for world peace, God's perfect kingdom, if you please, which, of course, they'll never realize, but there have been people that have realized it, and the man in this chapter, in these chapters we're going to talk about, he did realize this peace, this kingdom of peace that God was talking about. All right, so I want to talk about the passing of the torch. As usual, I will put my outline on the board so you can follow me and when you can begin to be relieved that we're getting close to the end. All right. Number one will be the torch preserved. And that will be chapter 24, verses 1 to 67. By the way, that's the longest chapter in the Bible. That was another challenge to deal with these long chapters. All right, the next one will be the torch passed. And that will be 25, verses 1 to 28. And then we have a sad incident, the torch pond. And that will be 25, 29 to 34. And then finally, we will have the torch perpetuated. And that'll be 26, verses 1 to 34. So we'll try to cover these aspects of the passing of the torch this morning. All right. We come to a very crucial event in the history of God's special people, which began with Abraham, and he had, through all the lessons of life, followed faithfully, repented thoroughly, and kept on the way, and experienced many blessings. And now Abraham is approximately 140 years old. He's only going to live another 35 years. And his son Isaac is 40 years old, and Abraham realizes what is pretty obvious, and that is that he's going to pass off the scene, and this torch is going to have to be passed to a new generation. Oh, a new generation. There is no new generation. It's only Isaac. He needs a wife. Where in the world is Isaac going to find a wife? Certainly not going to find it in the land of Canaan, among the heathen. It's going to take a very special person. This is going to have to be a woman who believes the promise that God has given Abraham and his family. She's going to have to be a woman of piety. She's going to have to be a woman that's willing to stand by Isaac's side through all the tests of faith of this promise. And she's just going to have to be an unusual woman. Now, I'll say ahead of time, she did turn out to be an unusual woman. I alluded to that earlier. You know, we criticized Rebecca for her conniving with Jacob. And she did do wrong. It's not right to do what she did. Maybe it's not even right to do what Jacob did. I'm not 100% convinced that he was wrong in buying the birthright from Esau. At least the Bible doesn't condemn him. We'll get to that later. But the incident later definitely was not right. But the thing that struck me about this woman is she believed that promise. And she identified with Jacob, who was the son of promise, Isaac's son of promise. She identified with him. And she colluded with him, that's for sure. And she connived with him, that's for sure. But she believed that promise when it seems like Isaac was a little bit out to lunch. He got carried away with his son Esau. And, you know, Esau was a dashing figure well, we'll talk about him later. But just to tell you where I'm coming from with Rebecca, she turned out to be a woman who tenaciously identified with this covenant and with the son of the covenant. When her husband somehow, I don't know what was going on, but something wasn't working in his mind in relation to this covenant. So we're jumping ahead to the end of the story to say that this did turn out to be a fortuitous choice, this Rebecca. She did turn out to be a woman of tenacious identification with the promise that God had made to this family. Now, this is indeed a charming story. It has enthralled readers of all generations. And it chronicles a very, very crucial episode. Now, many have seen symbolism in this chapter. We're not going to talk much about the symbolism. They've seen Isaac as Christ. They've seen Rebecca as the bride being brought from another country, leaving everything to follow her husband. They've seen the servant as typical of the Holy Spirit that goes and brings, woos the bride and leads the bride and brings her finally to Isaac. That you can read commentaries of, I will say rather far-fetched analogies in this chapter. We're not going to dwell on that, although we might mention a few things as we go along, because there are some beautiful parallels that we see here, whether they were intended or not. All right, so we have in this chapter Abraham's concern to have Isaac have a bride that will not jeopardize this covenant, this promise, this torch, if you please. And the thread here was pretty thin. It all depended on this family, because Abraham did not have a bunch of people to carry this on, like we had later with the children of Israel. He had one son. And it was either do it right with this one, or the whole thing was going to be jeopardized. And so Abraham was very, very concerned that this torch get passed properly. All right? Now, it's interesting that Isaac doesn't take any initiative here. He is sort of an interesting person. You'd have thought Isaac, 40 years of age, would have been interested in finding a wife. But the thing that amazes me is his mother had died 3 years before this. And this boy was still focused on the devotion he had to his mother. And I will say that, this for any young man in the congregation that is anticipating marriage, probably that is going to be one of the most significant things in your life is your devotion to your mother. This is Mother's Day. Because what Isaac did, as you see it at the end of this passage, he took all of that devotion, all of that warmth of love, all of that focus that he had on his mother, and just immediately transferred it to Rebecca, and she got all of it. And so it is interesting how he was just basically going about his duties, focusing on his parents, especially his mother, and this didn't seem to be a great concern. He was willing to let this in God's hands. All right? So Abraham chooses a servant. Let's read a few verses here to get started. And Abraham was old and well stricken in age. I said he was 140 years old because we know Isaac was 40 when he got married and Isaac was 100 when Abraham was born. So that makes Abraham 140. And the Lord had blessed Abraham in all things. Now that song we just sang, Trust and Obey, I think one of my favorite hymn texts in all of hymnology is that third verse that says, we never can prove the delights of His love till all on the altar we lay. Now, there are many people that are wondering why their Christian life doesn't really give them everything that's promised. And if you would analyze, or they would analyze, and stop to think, they have made a partial commitment. And you never can prove the delights of His love. I'm not saying you can't experience anything from God with a partial commitment. I would question that, but I'll leave that. But you will not experience the delights of His love till all on the altar you lay. And Abraham, in the last message we had laid all on the altar. And now here it says that the Lord had blessed Abraham in all things. My, oh my. That's something I certainly want in my life. And like I said, the key to that is that song we just sang. You can't have that till all on the altar you lay. For the favor He shows and the joy He bestows. The joy is for, and I'm going to put a little word in there, only those who trust and obey. By the way, all of Christianity is summed up in that little three-word phrase, trust and obey. If you trust, you will do everything He tells you because you trust Him. If you don't obey, you don't trust. I mean, those two are, that song is a wonderful song. All right, let's go on to verse 2. And Abraham said unto his eldest servant of his house, that ruled over all he had, we're not told who he was. I doubt if he was Eliezer. He may have been. He'd be pretty old if he were. He'd probably be as old as Abraham. Put, I pray thee, thy hand under my thigh, and I will make thee swear by the Lord, the God of heaven, and the God of earth, that thou shalt not take a wife unto my son of the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I dwell. Now, there were two things here that Abraham was adamant about. It would have been to Abraham's advantage to marry Isaac off to some chieftain of the land, Abimelech's daughter. That would have really helped to solidify his hold on this land that God had promised him. That would have been a very smart thing to do in the flesh. But Abraham said, there's one thing that will not happen. My son shall not marry anybody in this land. I think he remembered that God was going to give him the land, which meant that these people were all going to be displaced. I think he saw the debauchery of most of them, although we do find some beautiful examples of the morals of some people in this land. But Abraham was adamant about two things. And the first one was, my son shall not marry anybody in this land. It shall not be a Canaanite. All right, let's go on. But thou shalt go into my country and to my kindred and take a wife unto my son Isaac. And the servant said unto him, peradventure the woman will not be willing to follow me into this land. Must I needs bring thy son again into the land from whence thou camest? All right, suppose I find the woman. Then she says, yes, I want to marry Isaac. But I'm not going with you that 500-mile journey to an unknown land, to someone I never met. I'm going to stay here among my people. He will come to me. And Abraham said, no way. This is the second thing he was adamant about. You will not. My son shall not marry anybody in this land, and the woman who marries him will have to come here. He's not going there. Why? Because all the promises were tied up in that particular geographical location. And Abraham realized that if his son left that location, he lost all of the promises. And so here's a man of faith. He's going to send this servant 500 miles away to people that almost don't remember him and never had met Isaac. He's going to find this unusual woman, and she's going to be willing to come 500 miles to land she never saw and people she never met. And she's going to be willing to do all that. Well, the servant had his doubts. The servant said, well, suppose she won't do it. And Abraham basically said, well, she will do it. But just to make you feel better so you don't get nervous about the whole thing, you go and do everything I told you to do. And then if it doesn't work out, you're free of your promise that you made to me, this very solemn promise you made. But there's no doubt in Abraham's mind. He simply did that so the servant wouldn't have a nervous breakdown on the way. So anyway, he said in verse 5, and the servant said unto him, peradventure the woman will not be willing to follow me. I've already read this. And Abraham said unto him, beware thou that thou bring not my son thither again. The Lord God of heaven, which took me from my father's house and from the land of my kindred, which spake unto me and that sware unto me, saying, unto thy seed will I give this land, and he shall send his angel before thee and shall take a wife unto my son from thence. From thence. He's coming here. And if the woman will not be willing to follow thee, then you're going to be clear from the oath. Only bring not my son thither. And so the servant promised. But you can see here that Abraham had no doubt. I mean, here's an old man who's tested God's promise to him over and over again. And he says, the promise says that he's to stay here. And the promise says, requires that he marry a holy woman. And I believe it's going to happen. All right? We're talking about the torch preserved. Parents, this is the kind of adamant commitment God expects if this torch is going to be preserved. You don't mess around with this. And of course, we've looked around and seen all the messing around that's happened in our generation, and we've seen the torch get lost all over the place. Well, they weren't like Abraham. Abraham said, there are a few things I will not compromise on because I know, I understand God's promise and I understand the conditions of that promise, and there might be some other things that we can talk about, but there are two things we're not going to budge on. All right? And so there they were. So, let's continue. And the servant took 10 camels of the camels of his master and departed, and it would have taken 10 camels because he had to take provisions for 500 miles. That's a long ways on a camel. He had to carry along enough food for his retinue. He also had to carry along some attendants. He also took a whole pile of gifts along. And he had to have food, of course, for himself. And so this was quite an order. But he could do that because all the goods of his master were in his hand, it says here. And he arose and went to Mesopotamia unto the city of Nahor. Now, you remember, at the end of the last chapter, we found out that someone had brought Abraham news about the family of Nahor, and Rebekah's name is even mentioned in that chapter. And so Abraham's starting to see that there's something in this land is going to be the answer to their need. And verse 11, now we don't find anything out about the journey, 500 miles. There probably could have been several chapters written about all the experiences they had on the way. But there's nothing said about that at all. It says in verse 11, and he made his camels kneel down without the city, by a well of water at the time of the evening, even the time that women go out to draw water. And it says the daughters of the, let's continue. He says something about the daughters of the people were going to go out. It's there in the passage somewhere. Now, so what happened was in these Mideastern cities, they usually had the well outside the city. Because if you had the well in the city, you have all these camels coming and going and all that carrying on in the middle of the city. So you put the city aside beside the well. And people had to go out of the city to get their water. And it was appointed, apparently, for the young girls to do this in the evening. Well, if you're looking for a wife, this would have been the place to go. Because they're all going to come out for water in the evening. You get a chance to look at all the girls in the city. So it's too bad we don't have a place like that today. But anyway, so he didn't have this all figured out. But he had it figured out that the place to go was where all these young women were going to be coming to draw water. And he's, of course, very concerned that he finds the right one. And so he tries to figure out, how can I find out what kind of qualities this girl has and that's going to be God's choice? And he knew that she would have to be from Abraham's people because Abraham definitely said she's to be from my people. So she'd have to be a girl from Abraham's people, his relatives. She'd have to be a godly, virtuous girl. She'd have to be strong and healthy to make this long trip and watch over the large household that Isaac is going to have. to be the person she should have been. She's going to have to be like Isaac's mother, who was very hospitable and generous, hearted, big-hearted. So he thought, well, probably the first thing I can do is ask her for a drink. But then the problem with that is probably any girl was going to say, yeah, sure, I'll get you a drink. And then he thought, well, you know, I'm going to ask for more than that. I'm asking you, Lord, that whoever this girl is, she's going to offer to water my camels. Now, you have to think about this. This man had 10 camels. And they probably had done the last stretch without drinking. A camel can go 5 days without water. And I don't know, maybe they watered them the night before. But I can see that they were on the home stretch or we're almost at Nahor. These camels can make it without the last watering. So they end up at Nahor. Now, camel can go 5 days without water. And when it does drink water, it will drink 5 gallons per day. So we have 10 camels that are going to drink 25 gallons of water apiece maximum. So that means this girl's going to have to put her pitcher down. They claim that these wells often were shallow wells, and they actually went down steps. But anyway, however she did, either go down the steps and up or put the pitcher down and draw up 250 gallons of water to water these camels. That's a lot of water. It was going to be a long, wearisome, hard task that she was going to commit herself to. And so he does that. He prays this prayer. And let's read a little bit more here. He says, verse 11, he made his camels kneel down, and he said, O Lord God of my master Abraham, I pray thee, send me good speed this day, and show kindness unto my master Abraham. Behold, I stand here by the well of water, and the daughters, there it is, of the man of the city come out to draw water. And let it come to pass that the damsel to whom I shall say, let down the pitcher, I pray thee, that I may drink. And she shall say, drink, and I will give thy camels drink also. Let the same be she that thou hast appointed for thy servant Isaac. And thereby shall I know that thou hast showed kindness unto my master. Now you're going to find that this servant, whoever he was a very, very pious man. And that's testimony itself to the kind of household that Abraham kept. You're going to find this man constantly worshiping God for each step that happens here. And finally, you're going to find him on his face on the ground. He's going to be so overwhelmed and want to give recognition to God. So this whole thing is bathed in piety. Okay? And it came to pass, verse 15, before he had done speaking, that behold, Rebekah came out, who was born of Bethuel, son of Milcah, the wife of Nahor, Abraham's brother, with a pitcher upon her shoulder. And she was very fair to look upon, a virgin, neither had any man known her. And she went down to the well and filled her pitcher and came up. But it looks like it was steps down to the well, doesn't it? And the servant ran to meet her and said, let me, I pray thee, drink a little water of thy pitcher. And she said, drink, my lord. And she hasted, let down the pitcher upon her hand and gave him drink. And when she had done giving him drink, she said, I will draw water for thy camels also, until they have done drinking. And she hasted and emptied her pitcher into the trough and ran again to the well to draw water and drew for all his camels. Now this, she didn't know who he was. Now if she'd had ulterior motives, if she'd had any idea why he was there, we could understand why she did this. But she's doing this to a perfect stranger, not having any idea there was anything in this for her. All right? And this servant, it says, he wondered at her and held his peace, to wit, whether the Lord had made his journey prosperous or not. He still was not able to say. This was rather amazing that God had answered this prayer even before he finished praying it. This happened. But he still had to know. Who was she? Who was she? And so the next question is, who are you? And she says, where are we here? Where did I miss my place here? 24, okay? And she said unto him, I'm the daughter of Bethuel, the son of Milcah, which she bare unto Nahor. You know, that's the name we heard way back there. You know, something's coming together here, he realized. We have both straw and provender enough and room to lodge in. And the man bowed down his head and worshiped the Lord. And he said, blessed be the Lord God of my master Abraham, who hath not left destitute my master of his mercy and his truth. I being in the way, the Lord led me to the house of my master's brother. Now, by doing what she did, she demonstrated a beautiful character. I tried to list the qualities I saw in her as I read this passage. She was beautiful, the Bible says. She was pure. She was kind. She was energetic. She was strong. She was sensitive. She was selfless. She was hospitable. You girls listening. All right. She had these
you know,
here was an energetic woman, irresistible in her charm, I'm sure, who was generous and selfless and hardworking and you name it, hospitable, sensitive, all the qualities that any man would ever want in a woman. She demonstrated by that one thing that she volunteered to do. All right? And so, of course, he immediately is overwhelmed, and he, I told you, is a very pious man, and he says, I being in the way, the Lord led me. Now, I want to make a few comments on that. You know, a lot of people are trying to get leading from God. Well, the best way you can get leading from God is to be in the way. If you're in the way, God will make sure you stay in the way. But there are a lot of people that will not walk as Abraham walked, and this servant was walking in obedience to Abraham's command, who are always saying, oh, Lord, oh, would you please lead me? You will get no leading from God if you're not in the way. And a lot of people are crying out to God and can't figure out why they can't figure out what they're supposed to do with their lives, why things aren't working out, because they're not in the way. And if they'd be honest with themselves, they would say, I have not been fully obedient to what God has told me. Okay, then get up off your knees and go do that. Because as soon as you get in the way, you will get leading. The fact of the matter is, God wants to lead us worse than we ever want to be led. He says in Psalm 32, verse 8, I will instruct thee in the way that thou shalt go. I will guide thee with mine eye. But be not as a horse or as a mule who must be held in. It won't happen if you're like that. God promised this. In fact, I tell people, come to me and say, I'm trying to find the Lord's leading in my life. And I say, well, you can't help but find the Lord's leading in your life because He's promised to give it to you. It's going to happen. But the question is, are you in the way? That's the question. And he said, I was in the way, and it just naturally went where it was supposed to go. My favorite character in all of literature is Dolly Winthrop in Silas Marner. Now, I must introduce you to Dolly Winthrop. She can't read. She is totally illiterate. She's a very simple-minded woman that can't make much sense of anything. And Silas went to her one time, after she became a friend of his, and asked her about a very difficult experience he'd had in his life. And Dolly Winthrop said, and I just love this, she said, well, Mr. Silas, she said, I can't answer you. She said, I never have been able to figure out the big things in my life. But I have learned that the things that are right in front of my nose are very clear, and I found out that if I do those, all those other things take care of themselves. No, that's not profound philosophy. But that's what he's saying. If you do what's in front of your nose, then God can lead you by your nose, and you will eventually end up on the mission field or end up teaching school or whatever it is God, whatever big calling God has in your life, He's going to lead you by your nose. Just make sure that you're in the way. And that's a testimony of my life. I don't think I ever set out to do anything great, probably never have done anything great, but what I have accomplished, if I've accomplished anything, it's simply because I tried to put my whole heart into doing what I knew was right, right in front of my nose. And I think I can say with this man, I being in the way, the Lord has been able to get me to where He wants me to be, step by step, without me even knowing it. That's a beautiful promise. But the question is, are you in the way? Are you in the way? Well, she was lavishly repaid. She didn't do it for this reason. But if you look here, verse 22, and as it came to pass the camels had done drinking, that the man took a golden earring, a half shekel weight. I wish I'd have figured out that was a heavy thing. The commentators say it was for her nose. Now I wouldn't want to warn it. Maybe she didn't wear it. And for her hands of 10 shekels weight of gold. And he said, whose daughter art thou? And she said who she was. And of course, he gave credit to God. Now there is a gospel principle here too. And as we don't seek these things, but God does lavishly repay His servants who do what He tells them to do. I always like that verse that says, seek ye first the kingdom of God, and all these things shall be added unto you. Well, everybody wants to work for the government. That's where the best pay is. That's where the best benefits are. That's where the best retirement is. Can you imagine working for God's government? Do you think He takes any less care of His government employees than the U.S. government does? No. The picture is here. He lavishly repays. Now, that doesn't say there aren't trials. These people all had their trials. They went through their difficult experiences, and they had their common sufferings, and they got their chastisements and all of that for the wrongs that they did. But it says back here that the sum total of Abraham's life is he was blessed in all things, just like this woman was for her response. Okay? Well, so he comes to the house. Well, her brother Laban runs out. And it's sort of interesting how it says about him. Verse 28, and the damsel ran and told them of her mother's house these things. And Rebekah had a brother, his name was Laban. And Laban ran out into the man into the well, and I smile when I read this. And it came to pass when he saw the earring and the bracelet upon his sister's hands. And when he heard the words of Rebekah, his sister, she probably told him about all the wealth that was back there in that country. We know from later history of this man that he was particularly focused on these things. Now, maybe at this point he wasn't. Maybe this was all genuine, but I had to sort of wonder what his motives was. Anyway, he brought the man in and lavishly entertained him and was just a wonderful host to him. Gave him provender for his camels, water to wash his feet, and everything that he needed. And then they said, now let's eat. And I'm sure that this servant by this time was very hungry. But he was really in suspense now. Here's the woman that they heard about, the exact one. She fit all the qualifications. She had done what he had prayed. She was who he knew she needed to be. She was the exact person that he saw the qualities she had. It all depended now, are they going to let this girl go? Because that was his concern when he left. Abraham, suppose she won't come. And so he couldn't eat. I don't think you would have either. He was in a tremendous suspense. What is going to happen? We have the girl. Is she going to come? Or is she going to say, he has to come to me? And then this whole thing will be... If Abraham would have been there, he'd have said, can't you see? It's all working. She's going to come. But he wasn't sure. So he says, before we eat, I need to tell you my errand. Of course, by that time, they were in great suspense too. I kind of think after all that happened, they sort of had an idea of what was coming. All right, so he tells them. He says, I am Abraham's servant. Well, they remember there was such a person. Hadn't seen him for many years. And the Lord has blessed my master greatly, and he's become great, and he has given him flocks and herds and silver and gold and men servants and maid servants and camels and asses. And Sarah, my master's wife, bare a son to my master when she was old, unto whom he's given everything that he has. Not only is my master rich, but it's all coming to this son that this bride is going to have for a husband. And my master made me swear, saying, thou shalt not take a wife of the son of the daughters of the Canaanites. You should go to my kindred, and you're not supposed to take my son there. She's going to have to come with me. And he says, the Lord before whom I walk will send his angel with thee to prosper. It pretty well tells the story we've already heard. And so when he gets to the end of the story, he tells such a story of the wealth and the leading of the Lord that these people have to believe him. And so they said, well, what can we say? I mean, you've just painted a picture of something that we can't resist. By the way, these people were not true followers of God the way Abraham was, but they did believe in one God, and all of this that Abraham was following had started back there in Haran. And they were not immoral heathen people. This woman was pure, you notice. There were some things about them that were focused toward the true God. And so they make their response, and they say she can go. All right? Well, they go to bed. They eat, they go to bed, get up the next morning. And he says, I want to leave right now. Oh, they said, can't you stay at least 10 days? We don't want to send her off right away. Well, I think he had good reasons. I think he understood something, that God had made his will clear. There wasn't any more revelation going to be given. He knew exactly what he needed to do next. Number two, I think he realized that a delay in such a situation is not usually a very good thing to risk. Because during that 10 days, it seems to me like this family wasn't too terribly hepped on the idea of her going to begin with. Yeah, well, okay. Yeah, well, what can we say? What do you think is going to happen during 10 days? He knew very well that there was a tremendous risk that they would start to work on him to have it go the other way. And after 10 days, who knows what would have happened. And he knew, and that's another lesson. There are just lessons through this whole thing. When God tells you to do something, go do it. If you put a delay in there, you're going to start rationalizing. You're going to start talking to other people. And most other people aren't very radical. I don't know if you found that out, but I have. And so they start to say, well, after all, and after the delay is all done, you don't do. In fact, that's how most people live. They delayed. Abraham never delayed. God says, take your son up the mountain. Next morning, he's on his way. Now, there were times he didn't do what God told him to do, but when he did God's will, Abraham didn't put any space in there. He went ahead before his flesh had a chance to assert itself, before somebody else had a chance to reason with him, before he had a chance to rationalize himself. He was on his way. And I think this was very wise. It sounds a little bit rough, but this girl doesn't have a nice time to sort of get ready, get herself all together and say goodbye and kiss everybody and hug everybody, with extended family and have parties and so on. But this man knew that to delay in doing God's will is always a tremendous risk, and most people don't get the will of God done because they delay. Besides, this was a 500-mile journey. It was going to be another 500 miles back, and Abraham was sitting back there in suspense, just like this servant was in suspense. Abraham has to sit back there that whole time wondering, ooh, well, I don't think he was. I think he knew she was coming along. But even if he knew that, I'm sure he was human enough to wonder what it was going to be like. So anyway, and besides, he knew it wouldn't be any easier 10 days later. In fact, it'd be harder. And so if you stop to think about it, this was a very wise thing he did. So they head off. He says, hinder me not, seeing the Lord has prospered my way. Send me away that I may go to my master. This man is loyal. And they said, we'll call her. And they said, well, you go. And she said, I'll go. I think she was really excited. I don't think this was a problem to her. I think after he had described everything that was waiting for her at the other end, I think she was ready to go right now. Okay? And so they go. And they send her off with a blessing, which they had no way of knowing was what God had promised to Abraham. They said, may you be the mother of thousands of millions, and let thy seed possess the gate of those which hate them. Well, that's the promise God had made to Abraham. And God puts this in their mouths to say to her as they're sending her off. May you be the mother of a multitude of people, and may they be mightier than their enemies, and may they rule over their enemies. And they left, and they go their way. And then we see Isaac. Isaac apparently had chosen to move away from his father's house to establish his own house. And he had moved down further south. It gives you the place there. They tell me that's the exact place where Hagar met the angel and a well of water there. And that's where he was going to go and live with his wife. But it says he was on his way. Look, it says verse 62. And Isaac came from the way of the well of, I'll let you say it, for he dwelt in the south country. It seems to me like he was on his way back. He knew that this servant was going to be coming back to Abraham, and so he had calculated about how long it was going to take, and he was on his way back to his father's house, and he went out in the field at eventide to meditate. Now that's, of course, a tremendous insight into his character. He apparently was a very spiritual man. He saw all this as something God was going to have to do. And so here he is meditating. Here he is praying. It seems like it must have been a habit with the man. And of course, he sees her. She proves to be the person she promised to be. She very modestly gets off the camel. Actually, they say that word there actually means she fell off. She was so excited that she couldn't get off fast enough. And she put a veil over herself. She meets Isaac. It's very simple. He takes her into his mother's tent and transfers all his love of his mother to this woman. It's a beautiful picture. All right? So that's the torch preserved. Abraham's determination and God's moving in the whole thing to make sure that this torch, this light, this kingdom, this covenant did not get compromised. And so here we find the one girl probably in all the world that was up to this tremendous responsibility without any compromise. It's a beautiful picture. Okay? The torch is passed. Now, Abraham, after Isaac moves away with his wife down there to that southern city, whatever the name of it was, apparently Abraham then was by himself. And he was an old man, and he was lonely. And so he marries this Keturah. Now, I don't know where she came from, but I'll guarantee you that she believed in the promise and all of that. If he wasn't going to compromise that for his son, he certainly didn't compromise it for himself. And so he married this Keturah. And we find out that when God rejuvenated his body back when he was 100 years of age, it stayed rejuvenated, and this man had six sons. All right? And it seems like these people merged with the descendants of Esau and Ishmael eventually, and they became what we know today as the Arab nations. And Abraham was a good father, like he had with Ishmael. We told you he loved Ishmael. He loved these six boys as well. And he gave them good provisions, but he sent them away. He's going to pass the torch, and he doesn't want anybody to misunderstand. The torch is going to go only to Isaac.
So he makes sure all these other people go. They all have to leave. All right? So it says there, verse 5, and Abraham gave all that he had to Isaac, but unto the sons of the concubines, I think that's Keturah and Hagar probably, which Abraham had, Abraham gave gifts and sent them away from Isaac his son while he yet lived eastward unto the east country. And of course, that's where they still are. And these are the days of the years of Abraham's life, which he lived. 175 years is 175 years. And he gave up the ghost and died in a good old age, an old man and full of years, and was gathered unto his people. I told you the last time that the doctrine of the resurrection in the Old Testament is not a very prominent doctrine, but here it is. He was gathered to his own people. They were still in existence somewhere. And he went to be with them. I don't think it meant there in that grave, because the only person that was there was Sarah at that point. I think this is referring to the fact that Abraham was carried beyond this life to something else. Of course, we find out in the book of Luke that all of the faithful people up to that point, 1,900 years later, were in Abraham's bosom. So that's what this is referring to, I think. And his sons, Isaac and Ishmael, who apparently were at least had reconciled with each other, buried him in the cave of Machpelah in the field of Ephron, the son of Zohar the Hittite, which is before Mamre. And verse 11, and it came to pass, after, we're talking about passing the torch. It came to pass, after the death of Abraham, that God blessed his son Isaac. So this blessing, very clearly we're told, this torch did get passed. It gets passed to Isaac, and the blessing that was on Abraham now is poured out on Isaac. Now we're going to find in the next chapter that it really becomes evident. And then we have Ishmael. God made great nations out of them. It said they had castles. It's quite a statement here. Verse 16, these are the sons of Ishmael, and these are their names by their towns and by their castles, 12 princes according to their nations. And these are the years of the life of Ishmael, 137 years, and he gave up the ghost and died and was gathered unto his people. I sort of get the impression there. You know, I have just really been impressed by reading through this, the mercy and love of God. Now, Ishmael, of course, was not permitted to be the child of the promise or the child of the covenant. But there's at least a hint here that Ishmael was a true believer in God, and that when he died, he was gathered, he went on living with his people as well. Now, I guess the question would be who his people were. But anyway, that just was interesting to notice. It says the very same thing about him it says about Abraham. And they dwelt before Havilah unto Shur. It tells you where the Arab people basically live to this day. And anyway, Isaac was 40 years old, verse 20, when he took Rebekah to wife, the daughter of Bethuel, the Syrian, and so on. And God is not just going to follow through with everything hunky-dory. He's going to test this man. He was married 20 years, and there were no children. And so he realizes that this son that he's going to have, this son of promise, is not going to be a natural son any more than he was a natural son. This was going to be a supernatural act of God. So Isaac takes this very seriously, and he takes his wife, it seems to picture it, and they go and they earnestly seek the Lord. They entreat him. That's a very strong term. And lo and behold, she conceives. Not just one child, but two. And then it really gets exciting. These children, they're going to fight all their lives, and they started in her womb. Now, I don't think this was the normal movement that women feel. I think this woman was having a traumatic experience with these twins in there carrying on. Because the picture it gives is that she really figured, why in the world? What's happening? Why do I have to go through this? She says, if it be so, why am I thus? What's going on here? And she went to inquire of the Lord, and the Lord said, it stands to reason. You have two nations in your womb. That would be a rather stiff order. Two nations are in thy womb, and two manner of people shall be separated from thy bowels. The one people shall be stronger than the other people, and the elder shall serve the younger. Now, I told you that Isaac seems to have lost sight of that when it came time to pass the torch. And his focus was going to Esau, and he was going to give Esau the blessing, which I think was only part of what Esau was supposed to get. But that's what Isaac was going to do. But she heard this prophecy. And like Abraham, she took it very seriously. The youngest one is the one. And so the mother identifies with the youngest one. And we often talk about this family having partiality. I don't know if so much she had partiality toward Jacob as she just identified, she saw qualities in him, and we're going to talk about those in just a minute, that she did not see in Esau. And Isaac was the one that was out to lunch. He somehow, this he-man, Esau, this big playboy, that we're going to find out, he loved to go out hunting. Well, why was he hunting? They had more flocks than you could shake a stick at. He didn't need food. He didn't need to go out and hunt. He sounds to me like Nimrod. That's the last person we heard was a great hunter. This boy just likes to mess around. Jacob stays at home and says he was a plain man. What that literally means, it means he was a perfect man. He was a complete man. He was a mature man. We always had the picture Jacob was just sort of blah looking and had a blah personality. Well, I think we know he didn't have a blah personality. He had quite a personality. But we get the picture that Esau was this handsome guy and Jacob was this What it really means is he was a responsible person. He stayed at home. He helped his parents. We're going to find out that his parents were farmers. They sowed seeds. It's the first mention we have of people who weren't really nomads. They actually had settled down to farming. This boy stayed home and helped his parents. He was responsible. He was industrious. He was complete. He was perfect. The word perfect here is the same perfect we find mentioned when we talk about Job was a perfect man. It's the very same word that we have here for plain. I don't know what our translators actually did. It's a tremendous disservice, and Jacob has been impugned all these years because of this description. But no, it's a good picture. And Rebecca saw that, and she remembered the promise. This is the guy, that playboy that's out there that's having a jolly good time, hunting, doing what he feels like doing when it's not even necessary because he likes to hunt for the sake of hunting. By the way, you can take that for what it's worth too. Anyway, he's not the one. I identify with Jacob. Now she carried it a little too far, but let's remember, Abraham did some things to make the promise come out too once upon a time. And Isaac, we're going to find, he did some messing around here in the next chapter. So don't be too hard on Rebecca. So she did fail, but the woman had it right. She knew where the promise was, and she identified with the promise. All right? She took that prophecy seriously. So it says, here it is, and she got it. And when her days were to be delivered, were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb, and the first came out red, all over like a hairy garment. So he was a hairy man with red hair, I think. And he had hair all over him, so he was red. And after that came his brother out, and they were still fighting. His hand was on his heel. And his name was called Jacob, which means heel catcher. That's literally what the name means. So they said, that's who he is. And that's what he did all his life. He was on the heels of his brother. All right. So then we have this sordid picture. And the boys grew, and Esau was a cunning hunter, a man of the field. And I would just put, if you want to write something in the margin, he was a playboy. That's just basically. I preached a sermon here years ago. I pulled it out and looked at it. Esau, a jolly good fellow. If you'd have met these two guys, I think you'd have really liked him. I mean, he was, oh, sure, you can have my birthday. Just generous. Yeah, fine, whatever. All right? But Jacob was a plain man. He was a responsible person. He was a mature person. He was a complete person. He was a perfect person, dwelling in tents. And that seems to sort of carry the idea that he went back to the places of Melchizedek, and he sought out the oracles of the past and acquainted himself with what had been going on in the past of his ancestry. I don't know. That might be reading too much into that, but some people say that. And Isaac loved Esau because he did eat of his venison. Well, what a shallow reason. I mean, something has happened to Isaac here. He's not doing too well. Now he gets back on track again, like all the patriarchs do eventually. But right here, he's not doing too well. But Rebekah loved Jacob. And Jacob sowed pottage, lentils, red lentils. And Esau came in from the field, and he was faint. And Esau said to Jacob, feed me, I pray thee, with the same red pottage, for I'm faint. Therefore, his name was called Edom. They gave him a nickname the rest of his life because of this. Now, I'm sure there were other lentils in the house. I'm sure in a few moments, this boy could have cooked for himself his own pot of lentils. But he's a man of the moment. I'm hungry. There are the lentils. I want them, and I want them now. And I kind of think that Esau had been told this prophecy. I think Isaac had been told this prophecy. I think they all knew what God had said. And I think Esau just deliberately chose to, it'll take care of itself. I don't have to worry about it. I'm the oldest son. Or whatever he thought. I don't know what he thought. And I'm just imagining that for a person like Jacob, who was very serious and took this very seriously, he probably was pretty irritated with this guy's flippancy about this promise. I think you'll find this was the discussion before. This didn't just come up now. And so Esau just comes in. And Jacob, I wonder, didn't say it sort of in jest. Well, you can have it if you'll sell me your birthright. Now, I'm reading between the lines. But that's the kind of person Esau was. A joker. And lo and behold, he said, yeah, I'll sell you my birthright. I think Jacob was flabbergasted. I don't think he expected this. I really don't think he expected it. And we're always picturing him as this conniving person. He knew the birthright belonged to him. He didn't know how he was going to get it, because Esau was the one that his father was going to give it to. And this was on his mind. And so immediately, that's what he said. And then after Esau says, I'll sell it to you, he says, would you swear that to me? Because he knew that if Esau made an oath out of it, then Isaac could never undo it. He knew that Isaac would have to respect that. I think it was an act of misguided faith, maybe, but an act of faith nonetheless. Jacob wanted that birthright. That birthright meant that he would be the spiritual leader of the family, that all the promises that God had made to Abraham spiritually and materially would come to pass in his life. He would be the person through which that blessing would go. And I can understand, if I had been him, it would have worried me. How is this going to happen? Because my dad is going toward Esau, and Esau is the one that really is supposed to have it by the right of primogeniture. So here he is struggling with this, and then he says this, and this guy accepts it, and he says, let's swear, let's get this settled. So they do. And this became such a joke against Esau that they, from that time on, they called him Edom. Red. He's focused on red. Red potties, red hair, red everything. He's a red guy. So he carries a nickname the rest of his life for his despising of his birthright. He pawned it. I like this word. My wife helped me find it. If you want to challenge sometime, make yourself an outline and commit yourself to alliteration. Anyway, I couldn't find it. This is the one. These came right away. This one, I was in the thesaurus pulling out my hair, and my wife said, why don't you use the word pawn? And it worked. That's beautiful. It's perfect. Where you pass something off as, whatever, for your own advantage. And that's what he did. All right? So, I want you to notice something here. Who is condemned? You don't see one word of condemnation for Jacob. The Lord apparently did not condemn this. This was maybe not the way Jacob should have acted, but it was right on schedule according to what the Lord wanted. The person that's condemned is the man who sold it. That's where the condemnation goes. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not justifying this kind of behavior. But the Bible does not condemn this. And Jacob was focused on something, and so was his mother. That was perfectly right. They just weren't like Abraham himself. Didn't have the patience to let God work out in his own way. That was the fault. Okay. The torch perpetuated. Let's conclude here. Isaac's faith has to be tested now, too. I told you his faith was tested with the birth of the children. I mean, God is not going to let any person just coast on the merits of a man like Abraham. See, Abraham set this all in motion. Isaac used the idea as well. He just has to. And he did, sort of. He didn't have nearly the experiences that Abraham had or his son Jacob. But he didn't go without his testing. So there was a famine in the land, and he wants to go down to Egypt. We find out in verse 2. He gets as far as Gerar, where the Philistines were living. Now, I need to explain something. The Philistines were not the power in the land that they later became. They were just a couple little tribes living here. They hadn't become very powerful yet. They had not become the nation they became later. And they were still dialoguing some and having some relationships with God's people and some good relationships along the way. Anyway, so he got to Gerar, and the Lord appeared to him and said, don't go down to Egypt. Dwell in the land that I shall tell thee of. Sojourn in this land. I will be with thee and will bless thee. For thee and unto thy seed I will give all these countries. I will perform the oath which I swear unto Abraham thy father. I will make thy seed to multiply as the stars of heaven. I will give thee the seed of all these countries. Give unto thy seed all these countries, and in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. Because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandment, my statutes, and my laws. I take that as a little bit of a backhanded rebuke to Isaac. Why does he say this is all going to happen because of the faith of Abraham? He says nothing about Isaac's contribution of faith. I think the Lord saw that Isaac was his faith was not what it should have been. You have this deal with Esau, and now you have a really bad incident where he does the same thing his father did. He says that Rebekah's his sister only for his father. That was half true. For Isaac, it wasn't true at all. And pretty much the same thing happened. Abimelech comes. Well, there's nothing supernatural here like it was with Abraham. Abimelech just looks out one day and sees Isaac acting the way no man should act except toward his wife. And he went to Isaac and he said, "She is your wife. I saw what you did." And Isaac has to admit it. So, he says no one's to touch Isaac or touch his wife. And Isaac sowed in the land. There you have his agriculture. And received that same year a hundredfold. The Lord blessed him. It seems like he repented of that sin. And he's getting himself back on track. The Lord blesses him and keeps blessing him and keeps blessing him. And he had possessions and flocks. The Philistines envied him. And for all the wells which his father's servants had digged in the days of Abraham, his father, the Philistines had stopped him. Apparently, the Philistines by this time realized that Abraham's family is eventually going to possess this land. And so all the wells that Abraham had dug, Isaac needed that water. He was a farmer, and his crops were prospering. He had cattle, and so he needed the water. And he goes to this well that his father Abraham dug, and lo and behold, it's filled up. And this well is filled up with ground. And this, I think the Philistines were saying, "Look, we want these guys out of our territory." So they stopped up all these wells. And Abimelech came to him and said, "Go from us. Thou art much mightier than we." And I'm saying the promise is perpetuated. Isaac is demonstrating now finally the kind of character that the people of God's kingdom demonstrate. He didn't argue. He could have said, "Look, Abimelech," I don't think this is the same Abimelech, but your Abimelech back there promised my father he could settle wherever he wanted to. And this land, he has a right to. And he dug these wells. He could have fought this out. But he didn't. He digged again. He departed thence, pitched his tent in the valley of Gerar, and dwelt there. And Isaac digged again the wells of water which they had digged in the days of Abraham his father. And he named them the same names. I think he was trying to say, "Look, these are Abraham's wells dug with the Abimelech's permission, and these belong to me." And Isaac's servants digged in the valley, and they found there a wellspring of water. And the herdmen of Gerar did strive. They wanted these guys out of the land. They did not want them to have any wells. They didn't want them to have any water. They did not want them to have what they needed for their prosperity. All right? They said, "The water is ours." And he named the well Esek, which means well of quarreling, because they strove with him. And they digged another well, and they strove for that too. And he called the name of it Sitna, which means the hate well. And he removed from thence and digged another well, and for that they strove not. And he called the name of it Rehoboth, which means the well of ample room. And he said, "For now the Lord has made room for us, and we shall be fruitful in the land." He went on up to Beersheba. It was a little bit like Abraham coming back to Bethel. Remember that time Abraham went down to Egypt and made a bad showing, and he came back to Bethel and got his life back together again? This is sort of what Isaac's doing. I think Isaac realizes now that he really needs to get back on track with his life. And the Lord appeared unto him the same night and said, "I'm the God of Abraham thy father. Fear not, I'm with thee. I'll bless thee. I'll multiply the seed for my servant Abraham's sake." And there he built an altar, the first altar he built, and called on the name of the Lord and pitched his tent there. And there Isaac's servants digged a well. Abimelech by this time realizes this is a mighty man and has God's blessing on him. He goes out and he says, "Look, we want to be friends." And Isaac says, "Well, you hated me and drove me out of your country." Well, he says, "We see God's prospering you." And so Isaac very peacefully says, "Okay, we'll make an agreement." They have a feast. And no sooner is the feast over than his servants come and say, "We found water." God's blessing was on him. And I think Isaac, by his peaceable behavior, we have this beautiful example of non-resistance here in the Old Testament. I think he shamed these people. I think they saw that God was blessing him. I think they saw he was making a good response. They were the ones that were wrong. And God, in a mighty way, brought reconciliation and blessing here upon Isaac. And then he called the name of the well in the town that grew up around it Beersheba, which means the well of oaths. And so we have the torch passed. We have Isaac now responding the way he's supposed to respond. The blessing and the covenant can go on. He's learned how to relate to God. He's learned how to relate to the people around him. And the torch has been successfully passed, and the light is being perpetuated. Beautiful story of these people. But I guess the blessing that I had in studying this, what's the faith of Rebecca? I guess I had always looked a little negatively on Rebecca, but I began to understand a little bit why she responded the way she did, and it blessed me. It really did.